Welcome to the Democracy Podogs podcast. This is my daddy.
My name is Justin Kemp, and I am your host as we explore the democracy paradox.
Liberalism is a contested concept. It means different things to different people. In the United States, it's often associated with the political left. American liberals advocate for bigger government to provide a wider social safety net. But in Europe, it means almost the opposite. Liberals advocate for free market reforms and smaller government. But almost everywhere, liberalism stands for civil liberties and political freedom. This is what people mean when they say liberal democracy. Some refer to it as classical liberalism. But it really has a more modern sense in its alignment with democracy. This is what we're usually talking about when we discuss liberalism on this podcast. Now, Robert Kagan has a new book where he argues there is a long-standing struggle in America between dual traditions of liberalism and anti-liberalism. His book is called Rebellion: How Anti-Liberalism is Tearing America Apart Again. Robert Kagan is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a columnist for The Washington Post. He was on the podcast last year to discuss his book, The Ghost at the Feast, about American foreign policy during the first half of the 20th century. Our conversation tries to make sense of anti-liberalism as a countervailing force in American politics. Bob makes the case that just like liberalism, anti-liberalism has a long political tradition. He outlines how anti-liberalism has evolved over time and how its current manifestation continues to threaten American principles dating back to its founding. This is a conversation that combines political theory with American history and contemporary politics. The podcast is sponsored by the Kellogg Institute for International Studies, part of the Keough School of Global Affairs at the University of Notre Dame. The Kellogg Institute was founded by Guillermo O'Donnell, one of the giants of democratic thought, more than 40 years ago. It continues to sponsor research on democracy and human development. Check them out at kellogg.nd.edu. You'll find a link in the show notes to their website. If you're interested in becoming a sponsor or would like to discuss ways to partner with the podcast, please send me an email to jkempf@democracyparadox.com. But for now, here is my conversation with Robert Kagan. Bob Kagan, welcome to the Democracy Paradox.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Well, Bob, I absolutely loved your new book. It's called Rebellion: How Anti-Liberalism is Tearing America Apart Again. You've got a lot of interesting lines in the book. I mean, there's just different parts where we can just pull out quotes and they just read really fascinating just as a standalone quote. One of them comes in the introduction. It's where you write, "The idea that all Americans share a commitment to the nation's founding principles has always been a pleasing myth or perhaps a noble lie." That comes across to me as pretty harsh. It's a very bold statement. Why don't we kind of dive in there? Why is it a noble lie?
Well, I think that in order for a society to hold together, there has to be some sense that we're in fundamental agreement and the system is intact. And there certainly is at least tacit agreement by everyone, at least most of the time, that this is the system that we're living under. But of course, historically, there have been times when people have not accepted that. We had a civil war over that very issue. Numerous different types of rebellion that didn't end in civil war, but were clearly a challenge to laws passed or decisions by the Supreme Court, like Brown versus Board of Education, which the South essentially rejected to the point where Eisenhower had to send the 82nd Airborne into Arkansas. So in retrospect, because things got patched up, we like to basically feel like we were all in fundamental agreement, but that covers over the fact that one side lost in all of those conflicts. And I think it's a mistake for us to assume that therefore the conflicts are over. That's really the message. It isn't necessary to be an American citizen to agree to the principles of the Declaration of Independence, for instance, and many Americans have not and probably do not today.
Is it the commitment to those principles that's a noble lie, or is it the founding principles themselves being so clear-cut and established that was a noble lie? Because obviously there's a lot of compromises that go along with America's founding principles.
Right. And some people, therefore, take the principles themselves to be inherently hypocritical and a lie. And I guess what I would say is the lie is that we're all following those principles, not the principles themselves. And this is where I think it's easy to misunderstand the founders. The founders were not unaware that their own actions, especially in the case of people like Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, who held slaves, were in violation of the very principles that they were advocating. They knew that was true. And so they were hypocrites in their life, but the principles that they were espousing were not hypocritical. They meant them. And in fact, you know, they, in various manners of wishful thinking, hoped that slavery would eventually just disappear, although they themselves were not willing to take that step. So the noble lie, again, it may be essential to say that these are all the principles that we are founding our government on, but it is certainly true that there has not always been complete agreement about those principles.
So the book kind of outlines that the major cleavage in American politics is really between the founding principles, the idea of liberalism, and an ethos of anti-liberalism. That's how I very much read it, that this is just a consistent thread that recurs in different forms throughout all of history. Is this an American phenomenon, or is this something that we can relate to other cultures and other societies and other parts of history, maybe European history particularly? Or is this something that's really more specific to the American experience?
Well, it's specific to the American experience in the following way, which is, first of all, although other governments have subsequently been founded on principles that are the Declaration's principles, the United States was the first. And in a certain sense, the United States is the only nation in the world that does not have a history other than being committed to those principles. Because, of course, the French are now committed to those principles in their government, but they've not always been. They were also a monarchy at one time. So that makes the United States unique. The other thing that makes the United States unique, of course, is the problem of slavery. Slavery and then the aftermath of slavery, the Jim Crow and the fundamental basic discrimination against Blacks and others, but particularly Blacks, which makes the American experience special. However, that being said, ever since liberalism was born in the 18th century, there has been a strong anti-liberal opposition to it. And that was certainly true in Europe, where the battle was fought out through the 19th century. If you look at Europe before World War II in the fascist era, liberalism was being defeated. And I think it's certainly true that as we look at Europe today, and I think you could look elsewhere too, but certainly in Europe, there is a fight going on between liberalism and anti-liberalism, which we're seeing, you know, whether it's with the AfD in Germany or various right-wing groups or the Le Pen people in France, etc. I think they are pretty overtly clear in opposing liberalism in the same way that many Americans do today as well.
Why do you use anti-liberalism instead of illiberalism or maybe another term that might be more common? I mean, I think you're the first person I've ever heard use the term anti-liberalism specifically.
Yeah, because I think that the problem with illiberalism is it sort of feels like maybe it's just happening by mistake, you know, that people are not sufficiently committed or they've gotten lazy. And I mean, there's obviously a truth to that. You know, Reed Zakaria didn't invent the term, but he certainly made it famous by talking about illiberal democracy, and such a phenomenon definitely exists. But I want to make the point that it's not just that people don't understand, they really do oppose fundamental liberal principles. And I think it's worth understanding why it makes perfect sense to oppose liberalism, depending on what your value system is. You know, liberalism is destructive of all kinds of traditions and hierarchies that people have lived with for millennia. And so it's quite a challenge to many traditions, and a lot of people are made uncomfortable by those challenges to their traditions, and it's understandable that they are. And I think sometimes people who do believe in liberalism believe that, well, that's the truth, and then other people don't get it. Whereas liberalism is not the truth. It is one perspective on human existence. And historically, it is a rare perspective on human existence. And so while we live in a world dominated, at least in America, have been living in a world dominated by liberalism, we therefore think it's sort of the natural evolution of humanity upward toward liberalism. But of course, that's a creation of our own, that idea. It could be that liberalism is a brief lacuna in an otherwise non-liberal world that did exist before 1776 and could well exist at some point in the future.
So you describe the founding principles as unequivocally liberal. Does anti-liberalism emerge as a response to that? Is it something that exists side by side along with the emergence and adoption of liberalism? Where do we really date this tension between liberalism and anti-liberalism within the American story?
I would date it to the founding, because as we were talking about earlier, it was clear that American society, although it had adopted these liberal principles as a doctrine, nevertheless was not behaving in that fashion. It was America prior to the Revolution was not a liberal society. And after the Revolution, it was also not entirely a liberal society. And I quote Benjamin Rush, who's one of the founders and one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, saying that we've changed our form of government and the principles on which it's founded, but it's not clear that we have changed our habits and our way of life. And that was certainly true, because of course there was slavery, even though the founders had made it very clear that there should be a separation between church and state, that religion should not be infused with government. Nevertheless, many of the states throughout the 19th century had religious tests for office. You had to be a Protestant, or you had to accept Christ, or some other way of putting it. But the society clearly was not conforming to what the founders intended. And they knew that there was going to be a process of unfolding. And by the way, they knew it was going to go in directions that they weren't necessarily happy with. I mean, John Adams is saying, yeah, eventually women are going to be asking for rights. He didn't think women should have rights, but he knew with the principles that they'd laid down that that's where this was going. So we have to understand that they did have a sense that how things were at the founding was not how things were going to be in the future if their liberal principles took hold.
There's a lot of threads that I want to pull on here. First off, I think it's very different, though, to say that we established liberal principles and we weren't living up to them and that we were progressing towards that over time. For instance, you brought up Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, and we can think of George Washington the same way, that they were slaveholders that recognized there was a problem with slavery, but they didn't quite know how to be able to get out of that institution yet. But they felt that their principles meant that they needed to find a way to be able to resolve that problem or to be able to escape that original sin, if you will, that they wanted to move in a liberal direction. Anti-liberalism is saying something different, in my opinion, and it says something different in your book, that it's not that there's customs that we haven't broken free of, that we haven't made society more liberal yet. It's saying that there's literally a countervailing force that wants to make things less liberal within the world, that wants to be able to move in an opposite direction, that's actually pulling things backwards at the same time that liberalism is moving forwards. I mean, that seems to be something that's very different than just that we're moving in a liberal direction and we haven't gotten there yet.
Well, the reason we haven't gotten there yet is because there's resistance to it. I mean, and so I'm emphasizing the resistance here because I think, again, because things turn out a certain way, we have a way of sort of patching over the fights that led to it turning out that way. So, for instance, there's no question that the South, until the Civil War, was overtly and explicitly anti-liberal. I mean, leaders like John Calhoun and other Southern leaders said explicitly that they did not agree with the principles of the Declaration of Independence. They did not agree with the idea of equality of all human beings. In the 1920s, when the eugenics movement, something else that we decided to forget from our history was how pervasive the eugenics movement. It was a very respectable view. And they felt and said, people who believed in that theory of racial hierarchies as a matter of sort of science, that it was scientifically the case that human beings were not equal. So there is a constant anti-liberal view. And if you move into the area of religion, for instance, you know, there is a tension between religion and liberalism. There's no question about it. In a liberal society, you can hold any views you want to have, but you cannot be sure that your community is going to hold those views, much less the society at large. Most religions are about all of us agreeing on what God is, what God wants, and what we're supposed to do. Liberalism cuts against that. So throughout American history, there has been a very powerful desire and belief that America is not, you know, a liberal society, but an ethno-religious society. It was a society of white Protestants, that it was founded by white Protestants for white Protestants to create a white Protestant society. A very large number of Americans today believe that America was founded as a Christian nation and is a Christian nation. Now, that doesn't mean we're heading for civil war, but it does mean that they do reject the fundamental liberal principles of the founding, because a Christian nation is different from a liberal society. So in a way, I want to give people credit for their views. Their views are anti-liberal. They regard liberalism as a hostile force in their lives. Whether they acknowledge it openly, whether they would articulate it that way, some people do articulate it very clearly that way. People like Patrick Deneen, who is very clear that he's opposed to liberalism. People talk about, you know, there's a post-liberal movement of conservatives. So I guess I'm trying to say there's a tendency to treat people who are not supportive of liberal principles as, well, they're affected by their economic situation, they feel that they're not being taken seriously, and all these psychological and material factors are clearly at play. But I think we have to take them seriously and say, yes, but they also do not believe that a liberal society is the ideal society.
Let's pull on this thread a little bit more. I think the antebellum South is the perfect gateway to really think about anti-liberalism, because it's easy to imagine that at the founding, we have slavery in America and that we just remain divided between free states and slave states up until the Civil War, and nothing much changes between them. But the antebellum South becomes progressively less liberal during this time period up until we get to the Civil War. John C. Calhoun is a great example. He didn't just think that slavery was a necessary evil that you wanted to find a way to get out of. I mean, he thought slavery was an actual good for society. I mean, he became somebody who believed very much in the institution of slavery. That's a huge departure from what we see from previous Southern politicians like Jefferson and Washington and Madison. I mean, that's a shift down the anti-liberal spectrum as we kind of get to Calhoun and we see some of the other Southern politicians as we lead up to the Civil War. So, I mean, I think as we think of anti-liberalism, it really is something that can become progressively less liberal within society if people allow it to do so.
Yeah, and I think the evolution of Southern elite thinking from the time of the Revolution, from the time of Jefferson and Washington to the time of Calhoun that you're talking about, is the response to the pressure that they're under all the way through this period, right? Because certainly beginning with the Missouri Crisis of 1819, when for the first time the Northern politicians are saying, hey, we are not accepting the further spread of slavery. That was the first time, you know, this is when Jefferson said it awakened him like a fire bell in the night, that the country was fundamentally divided on this basic issue of principle. And that's the way Jefferson saw it. That's the way John Quincy Adams saw it, that this was a principled dispute. So while slavery was not being threatened, it was sort of easy for slaveholders to say, yeah, we know this violates the principle, but hey, what do you want us to do? Or we're working on it, we'll get back to you, et cetera, et cetera. But when there is a full-on onslaught of liberal pressure coming ultimately from the federal government, then at a certain point they say, well, no, actually, not only is slavery not wrong, but it's actually a positive good, and it's actually good for the blacks that we're enslaving, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, whether Calhoun actually believed that or not, and sometimes people say they believe all kinds of things because they need to say it. They're defending themselves from attack. And this is the phenomenon that continues beyond the slavery period, where The federal government is being more and more under the control of liberalism. The founders' goals are being more and more fleshed out. The society is being conformed more and more to the liberal principles. And at each stage of that, there is pushback. There are people fighting against it. You know, it didn't end with the Civil War. It didn't end with the Civil Rights Movement. One of the attributes of liberalism is the belief that everyone will figure it out eventually. And there is an assumption that, yeah, we got to bring these people along. The whole concept of a backlash, by the way, which is being constantly spouted as a backlash against too much liberalism. The principle behind that is eventually they'll get there. Don't put too much pressure on them and they'll get there. I think what we've seen, and much to our surprise, is that no, they don't actually get there. You know, 100 years after the end of the Civil War, the South was still in rebellion against liberal principles. And I think that we believed that since the end of Jim Crow, that therefore everybody was now down with liberalism. But I think we've discovered, just as it was a shock to people in the 50s and 60s to see that this anti-liberal force was still in place, we're shocked to find that it's still in place today. And we don't even want to name it this. But I think that is the continuity. I think there's real continuity all the way through American history up until now of a significant portion of the public just simply not agreeing with the liberal direction of society.
So we're kind of dividing the world into liberals and anti-liberals, as if the tension is between different types of people with different viewpoints, different perspectives. Do you feel that the tension is also within ourselves, that we have a tension towards liberalism and anti-liberalism within ourselves, trying to kind of fight over how we actually believe in different views? I mean, we can see it with some of the founders and even within the country itself. I mean, shortly after the founding, liberalism was really being pushed from states like Virginia, where you had the Democratic Republicans fighting against censorship and fighting for free speech through Jefferson and Madison. And the Federalists were viewed as far more conservative. I mean, they were viewed as being much more in favor of state power, being very hesitant about liberal rights. Things really flipped as we kind of moved into the 19th century. But even if we think back to those Northern Federalists, they still had a lot of liberal views at the same time alongside those anti-liberal views. I mean, do you feel like the tension is within ourselves as well as within society at large?
Absolutely. And I think that really does get down to fundamental realities of human nature. And I think it's important to understand the degree to which liberalism in some respects is contrary to human nature, because human nature is inherently selfish. Human nature is, I need to take care of myself. I need to take care of my family. I need to take care of my extended family. And I need to take care of people who look like me and believe the way I do, etc. It has never been true in the history of humanity that people have said, yeah, and also those people that I hate over there, they also have all the same rights that I do. And so every person is torn between their own selfish interests and their own tribalism, let's say, and what are supposed to be universal principles. And that's where you get into questions of things that are not material, but where the founders talked about things like virtue. Virtue in a liberal society is valuing freedom for everyone as much as you value it for yourself. And that is not an easy thing to ask people to do. So for instance, one of the things that I talk about in the book, and I think, you know, I think this gets to your question about the Federalists in that period, although there is a distinction that sometimes people make, which I want to get into, that I think is the wrong way of looking at it. I'll come back to that. But yes, look at immigrants like Italian or Irish immigrants who were at one time treated by the Americans at the time as not being white people, for instance. And they were denied their rights because they were Catholics or they were not as white as some other white people. And so they used the tools of liberalism, the institutions of liberalism, the principles of liberalism to gain their equality in society. And then once having gained that equality, then they were like, okay, I'm good. And now I don't care about liberalism anymore because I don't need it. And so every single individual can situate themselves in society and decide that they're good now. So the bottom line is, yes, there is a tension in all of us. I do want to make a distinction between the dispute between strong government versus weak government. For instance, I mean, there's the inherent dispute between Hamilton and Jefferson at the beginning about how much government involvement in the economy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Those issues get treated as if they are about liberalism versus something else. I think they were all within the realm of liberalism. You know, those who wanted to have a strong federal government after the Articles of Confederation were concerned about the protection of individual rights because they believed that in the states, individual rights were not being protected. So it wasn't as if because you wanted a strong government, therefore you were less liberal. You could be more liberal because you wanted a strong federal government. It was necessary to have a strong federal government to impose the Supreme Court's decision after Brown, right? So liberalism versus its opponents takes a lot of different forms. I'm focusing specifically on protection of individual rights, which to my view is what the core of the founders' liberalism was about. And you can have disagreements about exactly how best to do that.
Yeah, I guess when I'm thinking of the dispute between Jefferson and Hamilton, I'm focusing exclusively on things like the Alien and Sedition Acts, which was a clear expression of anti-liberalism from the Federalists. Now, there's other aspects where they were more liberal than the Democratic Republicans. I mean, they were much more likely to be against slavery, even though that's a difficult subject to get into in the 18th century because there wasn't quite an abolitionist movement in the same way as there was in the 19th century. And to be honest with you, a lot of these figures is more myth than it is reality. I think there's been a real change in how we think about figures like John Adams since David McCullough wrote his book, and a big sea change in how we think about Alexander Hamilton since Ron Chernow wrote his biography on Hamilton. Because I think before we really saw those newer biographies on these figures, there was a sense that we kind of demonized people like Hamilton and Adams and kind of glorified Jefferson in those disputes. I think there's been a little bit more balance between the two in more recent years.
You know, a lot of the history was written by Democrats in the earlier period, and the Democrats liked Jefferson and they didn't like Hamilton. And then Henry Cabot Lodge loved Hamilton and he hated Jefferson. I mean, there's been a lot of politicization of that. But I think the important thing is that they really were all liberal. Now, you bring up the Alien Sedition Act, and I do think we have to make a room for the fact that in times of perceived national security crisis, even liberals tend to fall off the wagon a little bit of liberalism. You could look at what Bush and the Congress did after 9/11, but you could also look at what Roosevelt did, Franklin Roosevelt and Japanese internment, and you could look at Woodrow Wilson and the treatment of Germans and other anti-war people like Eugene V. Debs, et cetera. So that is a place where the perceived needs of national security unfortunately have this effect, although it's usually temporary because it usually is about the immediate moment of crisis that these things happen and then people feel bad for having done them. That's different from being truly opposed to liberal principles. And again, I just think we need to take seriously that being opposed to liberal principles is a long tradition in American history, dating back to the founding.
Well, let's dive into that a little bit deeper. In the book you write, the problem is and has always been the people and their beliefs. I've talked to a lot of people on this podcast where we go back and forth between whether it's leaders that lead people astray or whether it's leaders who are responding to constituencies that have those beliefs. It sounds like you're taking the side that leaders are responding to constituencies that have anti-liberal beliefs. I mean, does that sound right to you?
It is. Obviously, in a democratic system, there is a two-way dynamic between leadership and followership, if you will. I think it's pretty clear that any politician who strays too far from where the majority of Americans are is not going to be a successful politician. On the other hand, it's clear that political leadership does push people in a certain direction. And so, you know, I think the leadership of Franklin Roosevelt was really important in establishing liberalism as a more dominant force in America than it had been in the 1920s. I don't think there's any question about that. But I also believe that probably more important than that were the circumstances of the time, i.e. the Depression, i.e. World War II. But there's no question that there's a dynamic. But I do think we need to take seriously the views of the masses of people. You know, a part of this is, can you explain Donald Trump without recourse to the people who support Donald Trump? He didn't just come take a country that was completely liberal, uninterested in anything that he had to say, and convince everybody overnight. Obviously, he was tapping in to something that exists. And I think the thing that he did that even other conservative politicians haven't done would be to go all the way in tapping into anti-liberalism. Conservative presidents are not necessarily anti-liberal. In fact, most of them have been pro-liberal. People may not want to hear this, but George W. Bush was what I would call a liberal. He was a liberal conservative. Trump is an anti-liberal conservative. The closest thing to an anti-liberal conservative we've had as president, obviously you have to go back to the slaveholding South when they had presidents that were supporting them. I think you could see that to some extent among Republicans in the 1920s. That was fundamentally an anti-liberal force. But we haven't seen that since World War II, and that's what makes Trump special. He's effectively saying, I'm overthrowing this liberal system. I don't believe in these liberal norms. And clearly, the more he says it, the more a very large number of Americans say, yeah, right, we love it. You know, so it is a dynamic between leadership and existing popular attitudes.
When we dive into these ideas about anti-liberalism, we inevitably bring up ideas about white supremacy. I mean, those two seem to be very linked within American history. And it's not just your work. I mean, I've talked to Heather Cox Richardson, talked to many different people. And when we think about forces against liberalism, it's often tied to ideas about racism. Are those two ideas inextricably linked within American history?
They're certainly inextricably linked in American history. Whether that's the European question, I think the European questions are often different and depend on what's going on in those individual countries. But in the United States, yes. Because you take an existing society where white Protestants are in charge. That was a society that existed before the Revolution. The number one enemy at that time are not blacks, who they don't take seriously as people, but Catholics. I mean, it was a virulently anti-Catholic society, just as Britain was virulently anti-Catholic. So you start with that. And also you obviously start with a position of white supremacy. It was a country of white supremacy. So liberalism then erodes all that. Liberalism says you have to treat Catholics like they're equal to us. Liberalism says you have to treat blacks like they're equal to us. And so in a sense of just a matter of power, the result of that is that white Protestants, relatively speaking, are losing power and authority to other groups that they despise and think are evil. And so, you know, it's not surprising that there's a resistance and a backlash. And that is what, in fact, we've been witnessing for 200 years. You know, in the mid 20th century, the sociologists like Richard Hofstadter and Daniel Bell, they spoke of what they called status anxiety. And it was white status anxiety. And that covers a lot of ground. And I don't know how accurate it is, but it certainly gets to the idea that something is being lost, that the America that they know is being eroded or being changed by immigrants, by blacks, et cetera, all of whom are clearly using liberalism to raise their position in society and therefore lower, in a sense, at least diminish the authority of white Protestants. So, yeah. They are therefore anti-liberal because liberalism is the enemy of their supremacy. And so many adjust and say, that's fine. And most Americans have adjusted until recently to that reality. But there's also a constant resistance. And that's what we're seeing now, you know, really mounting up in a way that we just haven't seen it since the Second World War.
So when a group is marginalized, whether it be Catholics at earlier points of American history, particularly the 19th century, if it's Black Americans throughout most of American history, Hispanics, particularly more recently, but throughout most of American history again. Are these groups liberal because of their marginalization, or are they just opposed to a racially exclusive or a religiously exclusive form of anti-liberalism? Are they just fighting against that type of anti-liberalism? Or are they actually adopting liberalism because of their experience of marginalization?
I think it's the latter. I think that if you arrive in America, you're treated like garbage. The Irish were depicted in the Thomas Nast cartoons of the late 19th century as apes. And yet you come in and you have the opportunity to join a political party. You have an opportunity to vote. And at that point, because you are marginalized, because you're despised by the mainstream of society, you are continually pressuring to be treated like an equal. And so, yes, you're using liberalism to make your way in society. Does that mean that you become a true devoted liberal? I don't know, because then, as I say, having accomplished what you set out to accomplish, your descendants are now tempted by an anti-liberal leader because liberalism has already taken care of them. They don't need it anymore. And by the way, Jefferson talked about this in his Notes on the State of Virginia, which I quote in the book, where he talks about his fear. He's writing in 1781. There was a tremendous fervor for rights at the time of the Revolution. The experience of being oppressed by Britain in the 1760s has a huge impact on Americans' attitude toward their rights. And after the Revolution, and also because of the circumstances of what America was, the fact that people could move anywhere they wanted, there was a tremendous focus on rights. And so you could say that the founding was based on an obsession, an unusual obsession with individual rights. And what Jefferson worried about was that when this is all over and we don't have the British enemy to point to and we're just us, we're not going to be as jealous of our rights as we are during the Revolution. And Lincoln in 1838 says, yeah, we have forgotten what this was all about. And of course, the Civil War comes 2 decades later. So I think we have seen repeatedly a fading of passion about rights. And it is always true that those who feel that their rights are most threatened are the ones who are most determined to support a liberal ideal, the most interested in talking about the principles of the Declaration. Those whose rights are not threatened tend to be less concerned about the question of rights in general. And so that's why the missing link, in a way, is virtue. That even though you've got yours, even though you're a millionaire, even though you're a white person and you'll be fine, even if in a dictatorship, but nevertheless, you have a true deep belief in liberal principles and therefore you're willing in some sense also to sacrifice the authority that you might otherwise have in a less liberal society in order to support the principle of liberalism. And I think the degree to which the country has rested on a degree of passion about liberalism that may have faded in our time is something I think not to be ignored. And I think you can explain it circumstantially as well, because as I say, in the middle of the 20th century, there were all kinds of major factors that had the effect of strengthening liberalism and weakening anti-liberalism. But it doesn't have to last forever, as both Jefferson and Lincoln were concerned.
So you've already mentioned that as formerly marginalized groups begin to forget about their former marginalization, like as new generations come in that haven't really experienced that degree of prejudice, that degree of hostility in their lives, that they're more susceptible to anti-liberal views. One of the phenomenons that's hard to completely get our heads wrapped around is how Trump's numbers among Hispanics in particular, but also among Black Americans, has begun to actually increase over previous elections. Like, he's actually getting more support from those groups that we think of as marginalized. If that anti-liberal force does actually become more racially inclusive, is that more dangerous to liberal democracy, or is that considered a move towards liberalism? Is that a less anti-liberal form of anti-liberalism? Like, how should we think of that? Because it's possible that the numbers of anti-liberals could grow dramatically if they did become more racially inclusive over time.
Well, first of all, obviously that does seem to be a phenomenon, although in fairness, so far it's only shown up in polls. I want to see what actually happens in the election. And by the way, the Hispanic vote for Republicans was pretty high back in the George W. Bush period. I think he got something between 30 and 40% of the Hispanic vote because he was pro-immigration. He was clearly very liberal when it came to that issue. So I don't know how much of this is resilient. And we also know, of course, that a certain percentage of Hispanics are very religious, very conservative from a religious point of view, including the evangelical. And so they may be looking at themselves from that perspective, which would, by the way, indicate, and I think this is kind of what you're hinting at, indicate a certain feeling of acceptance in society. They're not panicked about being discriminated against. Therefore, they now have the luxury of this. But it's obviously strange to see that there would be any growth at all. But I want to wait until the vote before I see what happens. Because the one thing that I'm very confident about is that the next Trump administration is going to be more inflected by white nationalism than the last Trump administration. I mean, he basically didn't bring anybody in to his government that represented Christian nationalist or white nationalist attitudes. But when you listen to the people who are talking about populating his administration, people who are mentioned as likely to populate his administration, you are talking about a much more white nationalist, Christian nationalist. And let's not forget, Trump is the candidate of these people. He made himself the candidate of these people when he decided to run on the birther conspiracy in 2011. That was the signal to all these people who he was. So I think that once you started seeing how a next Trump administration governed on a lot of issues, he's talking about setting up in the Justice Department something to fight anti-Christian bias, for instance. You know, any minority groups that feel that they were all going to be okay under Trump may immediately realize that they're not. And I'm hoping that they understand that. Look, when 9/11 happened, George W. Bush went out of his way to say that Islam is a peaceful religion and to really push back on the rampant Islamophobia. Do we think that Trump is going to push back on Islamophobia if he's president? Do we think if there is another cop beating and killing of a black person, that he's going to make sure that those cops are tried and convicted for what they do? We've been living in a world where these horrible things happen, but the federal government is pretty clear about where it stands on something like that. And I think Trump would take the different view. So I think these minority groups are not kidding themselves that it doesn't matter to them whether Trump is elected. They like him for this or they like him for that. But I think they are not seeing what it is they're walking into.
Let's take Trump out of the equation. I mean, we see anti-liberalism in all different parts of the world. I mean, I think of India with Narendra Modi. And one of the things that I see with the BJP is the fact that it's much more inclusive of different forms of Hindus, but is more exclusive of other religions, particularly Muslims. I mean, we could see the same thing happening within the United States, where it one day anti-liberalism could be more inclusive of different racial and ethnic minorities within the country, but increasingly hostile to different religions like Islam, increasingly hostile to people who are considered intellectuals. I mean, it could still be just as anti-liberal, just as much looking for enemies, but at the same time, more inclusive of different racial groups. Again, is that something that is progress in terms of becoming less anti-liberal? Or is that perhaps scarier because they're potentially increasing their potential base of support?
You know, the thing is that we're in a kind of transition or mixed period here. The fact that there are a number of Catholics who are very pro-Trump and want what they call a Christian commonwealth, etc. And what's interesting to me about that is that what happened to the split between Catholicism and Protestantism? I mean, Catholics and Protestants have been killing each other for centuries over doctrinal disputes. So is that doctrinal dispute not going to be relevant in a quote-unquote Christian America? My argument is, insofar as you could even say that that is true, it's only because of what liberalism has accomplished in America. Liberalism has made it possible for Catholics and Protestants to live together and even to talk about something called a Judeo-Christian tradition, which, by the way, doesn't exist, but we've created it to make everybody feel it's part of liberalism's, you know, bringing everybody together. But if you actually have moved into a post-liberal society, which is what these Catholics like Deneen want, how are they so sure that that old issue doesn't come up again? I mean, for 150 years, you could not be a Catholic in America and aspire to political leadership. So is that just gone? In my view, if it's gone, it's because of liberalism. So if you take away the liberalism, who's to say that that doesn't return? I would think the same is true of India. They've been living in a liberal society. They're open-minded with regard to Hindus, even though they are extremely prejudicial against Muslims and other religions. But who's to say that after a decade of non-liberal government, whether the Hindus wouldn't start figuring out what their problems are with each other either, you know? I mean, we take for granted the degree to which liberalism has softened the edges of all the old disputes that used to roil humanity and lead to war. They have accomplished this in a liberal system. If you take away that liberal system, you might find that people have many disputes. And, you know, if you are actually going to create a Christian America, there has to be some Christian doctrine behind it. And the question of whose Christian doctrine is that's going to be will be an interesting question. It's one of the reasons the founders did what they did about religion. Even at the founding, there were numerous Christian sects, some of whom were worried that if you did have the church in control of the state or the church mingled with the state, it would be Episcopalians running the country, not Baptists, not Methodists, you know? So I do think that we need to remember that the reason we're all getting along on these things is because of liberal principles.
So, Bob, we've talked a lot about this almost eternal conflict between liberalism and anti-liberalism within the American experience. You've mentioned Patrick Deneen and the idea of post-liberalism. Is there a possibility of a post-anti-liberalism future for America? Like, is there anything that comes after this conflict, or is this fight between liberalism and anti-liberalism just never-ending? I mean, just truly eternal?
Well, I think the fight will be eternal just because, again, it's inherent in human nature. Human nature, to some extent, is in tension with liberalism. So I think you're always going to have some degree of pushback. However, in the United States, I'm optimistic if we can get past this election. Because look, one thing is pretty clear. One reason you're having this incredible reaction now, which takes the form of the Trump movement, is precisely because the population of whites, and particularly the population of white Protestants, is diminishing as a proportion of the country. We're moving toward a majority-minority country. And in a certain sense, I feel like this might be the last stand of this particular element of anti-liberalism, the white Christian element of anti-liberalism, because they're just going to be outnumbered by many diverse groups. And so in a way that the anti-liberals of the 1920s, you know, when they shut down the immigration in 1924, so they could just have, as Trump says, the nice countries coming in, Denmark and Norway and the other Nordics. The problem for them is that they closed the door too late. So many immigrants had come in that the fundamental complexion of the country was changing. That led to a huge burst of liberalism. And what we're dealing with now is the consequence of the 1965 immigration reform, which then let in tens of millions of other non-white Americans, and that has flooded into the country, and therefore the complexion of the country has changed. We're in an unusual situation where a distinct minority in the country has taken control of one of the political parties for the time being. You know, what happens to the Republican Party after Trump is gone? I don't know. I think it's in deep trouble. I think it is going to split in some fundamental way. But that is what happened. It's a little freakish. And so I think that the general trend in America has been toward support for liberalism just by virtue of the fact that there is no majority population to want to hold on to its majority position and its standing in society. So I'm actually hopeful that we'll eventually move past this. Now, that doesn't mean, as you say, that does not mean that there's not going to be a continual challenge. I think the challenge is always going to be there. And this is something I think it's hard for Americans to accept. Yes, you actually have to fight in every generation if you want to preserve liberalism. It's not just going to preserve itself. It's not just the end of history. It isn't just the final resting place of humanity, not by any stretch of the imagination. It's a continual struggle.
Well, Bob Kagan, thank you so much for joining me today. The book, again, is Rebellion, How Anti-Liberalism is Tearing America Apart Again. Thank you so much for writing the book. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure.
If you are listening to the show, please leave a review. It really does help shows like mine stand out. Also, please share the show with colleagues and friends, because word of mouth goes a very long way. Facebook and Twitter are great, but really just talk about it. There's a full transcript at www.democracyparadox.com. Thank you for listening.
We'll be right back.